Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And on the 7th of October, the prison inmates broke out of the prison. The Arab-Israeli conflict was made in Britain.
Was the writing on the wall already there for Jews in the region?
My mother used to talk at great length about the wonderful Muslim friends that we had in Baghdad.
Really?
Karkoukli planted 3 of the 5 bombs. Wow. The most famous bomb was the bomb, a hand grenade that was lobbed into the Sauda Shem Tov synagogue. The Druze thrived under the Ottoman Empire. Marilyn Monroe wrote in her scrapbook, "Nationalism stops us thinking."
Why did Britain give such an open promise for a Jewish homeland?
I'll answer your question. Israel is a racist state.
Your wife is the great-granddaughter of David Lloyd George.
Sir Keir Starmer is one example of a wider phenomenon, which is Western hypocrisy on Israel-Palestine. There is the master Zionist narrative.
Today we are confronting nothing short of a campaign of ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians of Gaza, not seen since the Nakba or catastrophe of 1948. Yet many in the Western world are silent to the suffering. Much of what justifies Israel and its actions in the West is premised on history, and many European and American historians have been ready to present a compelling argument for Zionism and the case for Israel in the heart of the Middle East. This historical justification based on persecution and anti-Semitism gives the story of Israel a potency that has for many years served to find acceptance in the West, of impunity to act without restraint that is not offered to any other state. At the same time, the Palestinian story has been undermined by these same historians. They were a Bedouin community readily able to vacate their land, it is said. Palestinians, according to leading Israeli politicians, are a mythical people. Today, we are honored to have Professor Avi Shalem with us to untangle the historical facts from fiction. Avi Shalem is an eminent historian. He is an emeritus professor of international relations at Oxford University and the author of The Iron Wall, Israel and the Arab World. Professor Shalem is a dual Israeli-British citizen who has lived in the country as a child. His family originate from Iraq and migrated to the newly founded state in 1950. Professor Avi Shalem, welcome to the Thinking Muslim. I'm grateful to have you with us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's wonderful for you to be with us today. Now, Professor Shalem, one of the narratives that justify Israel in the Middle East is the persecution of the Jewish Arabs in the region. I think more than 260,000 Jews migrated to Israel in the 1950s from the Arab world. How real was this persecution? Did the Muslim world have a Jewish problem?
There is a Zionist master narrative which says that Jews first faced persecution in the Arab world, that anti-Semitism was pervasive and endemic in the Arab world, and that in the aftermath of the Holocaust, the Jews had nowhere to go, and the newly born state of Israel provided a safe haven for Jews facing persecution anywhere, and that the newly born state of Israel was where the Jews who were being persecuted in the Arab world ended up in. This is the Zionist master narrative, and it's a simplification of the actual history. The actual history is one of Muslim-Jewish coexistence and harmony through the ages. This is not to deny that there was anti-Semitism in the Arab world or the Islamic world, but to say that the scale of anti-Semitism was greatly exaggerated by the Zionist narrative. Because anti-Semitism is a European malady. It's from Europe that anti-Semitism was transplanted to the Middle East. And it's interesting to note that there was no anti-Semitic literature in Arabic.
Really?
So with the spread of anti-Semitism from Europe to the Middle East, anti-Semitic literature had to be translated from Arabic, from European languages, into Arabic. And a prime example is Hitler's autobiography, Mein Kampf. So anti-Semitism was a European malady, and the Middle East did not have a Jewish problem, in inverted commas. Europe had a Jewish problem. In Europe, Jews were the other. They were singled out. They were the other. In the Arab world, in Iraq in particular, where I come from, Iraq didn't have a Jewish problem. In Iraq, there were many minorities. There were Christians, there were Chaldeans, there were Turkomans, there were Circassians, there were Jews. The Jews were one minority among many, and there was a long tradition of religious tolerance and of coexistence between the different minorities. So that was, for the most part, the reality, but it's not to deny that there were there was anti-Semitism, especially in the aftermath of the First World War. In the 1930s, there was a spread of anti-Semitic propaganda throughout the Middle East.
Now, Professor Shalem, you were born in Iraq, and your family were a wealthy family that had been well integrated into Iraq for many generations. Yet your family moved to Israel in the 1950s. I think something like 100,000 Jews left Iraq in that decade. Why did that happen? And can you expand on what you call cruel Zionism?
I was born in Baghdad in 1945, and in 1950, my family moved to Israel. We were a very wealthy, upper-middle-class family. We were very privileged. We had a very luxurious lifestyle in Iraq. Mm-hmm. But much more importantly, we were Arab Jews. We were Iraqis whose religion happened to be Jewish. And we were Arab Jews. We spoke Arabic at home. Our customs were Arab customs. Mm-hmm. We lived in harmony with our environment. My parents had many Muslim friends. Mm. And the context was one of coexistence between the different minorities. Mm. Moreover, we as Jews had very deep roots in Iraq. Our roots went back to the Babylonian exile of 2.5 millennia ago. So we were not newcomers.
Right.
We were not intruders.
Yes.
We had been there long before the rise of Islam. Mm. Zionism was a European idea.
Right.
Zionism was a movement by European Jews for European Jews. Mm. Because of anti-Semitism in Europe, Theodor Herzl, the visionary of the Jewish state, came up with a solution to the Jewish problem in Europe, which is an independent Jewish state. Mm. Once my mother used to talk at great length about the wonderful Muslim friends that we had in Baghdad.
Really?
And one day I asked her, did we have any Zionist friends? And she said, no, Zionism is an Ashkenazi thing. Mm. It's nothing to do with us. So Zionism took off in the interwar period. And persecution of the Jews fed the immigration of Jews from Europe to Palestine, especially after the rise to power of the Nazi Party in Germany in 1933.
Yeah.
And we, the Jews in Iraq, had no affinity with the Zionist idea.
Right.
It meant nothing to us, and we had no interest in leaving our country and moving to Israel. It's circumstances beyond our control that forced us to leave Iraq and to go to Israel.
Right.
And when I say circumstances, I mean two things in particular. I mean the rise of Arab nationalism and then the rise of Jewish nationalism or Zionism. Mm. And we were caught in the crossfire between these two national movements. Mm. And the fact that the Zionists in Palestine had embarked on the systematic takeover of the country and the expulsion of the Palestinians from Palestine exacerbated Arab hostility towards the Jews in the Mideast. Mm. The turning point was 1948, mm-hmm. the war for Palestine, the first Arab-Israeli war. The Iraqi army took part in the war for Palestine. At the end of the war, after the guns fell silent, Israel signed Israel signed armistice agreements with all its neighbors.
Yeah.
But Iraq did not sign an armistice agreement. It just withdrew from the Palestine theater. Mm-hmm. So officially, Iraq and Israel are still at war. And in the aftermath of the 48 war, in the aftermath of the Nakba, there was a backlash against Jews throughout the Middle East, in all the Arab countries. Mm. And there was a backlash against the Jews in Iraq. And that's when official persecution of the Jews began, in the aftermath of the defeat. The Jews were used as a scapegoat for both the Arab defeat in Palestine, but also for the failures of the Iraqi government domestically at home.
Yeah.
So the Jews, who had been positive element in Iraqi society, were increasingly perceived as a fifth column. And Arab nationalists who were anti-Semitic, who didn't like Jews, could say to Jews, you don't belong here, you're aliens, which they couldn't have said before. Yes. So Zionism changed things. Zionism gave a territorial dimension to the Jews for the first time in 2.5 millennia. Mm-hmm. And it now became easier for Arab nationalists like the Istiklal Party in Iraq to denounce the Jews, to call for their expulsion, and to call for the sequestration of the assets.
And to underscore this growing insecurity faced by Iraqi Jews, there were a series of bombings that targeted Jewish communities across Baghdad and beyond. What has your research told you about the origin of this violence?
In March 1950, the Iraqi government passed a law which said that any Jew who wants to leave the country is free to do so. They have a year to register, and they can leave on a one-way visa.
Right.
But the only place that the Jews who wanted to leave Iraq could go to was to Israel. Only a few thousand Jews took advantage of this new law.
Right.
The overwhelming majority wanted to stay because this was their country.
Yeah.
In 1950, there were roughly 135,000 Jews in Iraq, a substantial number. By the end of 1952, only about 10,000 Jews stayed, and something like 125,000 Jews had gone to Israel. And the experience of individuals in Israel varied, but for the community as a whole, for the Jewish community as a whole, the experience was traumatic. It's like a tree being pulled up by the roots. So not many Jews took advantage of the new law. And in the next year, five bombs exploded in Jewish sites in Iraq and created a panic, and this panic contributed to the mass exodus of the Jews. As a boy growing up in Israel, I always heard rumors that Israel was involved in the bombs, that Israel was responsible for the bombs, and with the aim of frightening the Jews and forcing them to move to Israel, whether they wanted to or not. These were the rumors. And I was always interested in this question. And when I grew up and when I became a historian, and I spent a year in the Israel State Archives in 1981-82, I wanted to get to the bottom of this story. And one day I ordered the files on Iraq 1950, and I was told they were not, they were closed. And I said to the state archivist, but more than 30 years have passed. And Israel has a 30-year rule for the review and declassification of official records. I said to him, more than 30 years have passed, so why don't you release? And he said, I'll look into it. And he came back to me and he said, there are some Mossad documents in the file.
Right.
That's why it hasn't been opened. And I thought, aha, the Mossad documents.
Right.
So there is incriminating evidence.
Yes.
So I said to the state archivist, why don't you go through the file and remove the Mossad documents and leave the documents of the foreign ministry?
Yeah.
And he said, I'll check. And the following day he came back to me and he said, it's not possible. None of the documents can be released. And then I thought to myself, I said to him, you must be hiding something. There must be incriminating evidence. And he said, I read the entire file and I assure you that there is no incriminating evidence.
Yes.
And I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I'm a historian.
Yeah.
And I didn't have any evidence pointing to Israeli culpability.
Yes.
But this issue continue to interest me. And when I was working on my autobiography, I met an elderly Iraqi named Yaakov Karkoukli, a friend of my mother's who lived in Ramat Gan, where many Iraqi Jews lived. Mm. And Yaakov Karkoukli was active in the Zionist underground in Iraq. And he told me in great detail about their activities, how they forged documents, how they paid bribe to officials, how they organized first the illegal Jewish immigration through Iran to Israel, and later, after the 1950 law was passed, the legal immigration to Israel. So he told me about their activities in the underground, and he told me that he had one colleague who was a very smart lawyer. His name was Youssef Basri, and he was an ardent Zionist, and he had gone to Israel after 1950, but was sent back by Israeli intelligence to Baghdad as a spy and to organize the Aliyah, the immigration to Israel.
Yes.
And as, this is according to Karkoukli, as there was very little take-up of the offer to leave voluntarily, Karkoukli planted three of the five bombs. Wow. The most famous bomb was the bomb, a hand grenade that was lobbed into the Sauda Shem Tov synagogue, and that killed four people. Mm-hmm. And that was the most traumatic event which sparked the mass exodus. Basri wasn't responsible for that. And there was another another hand grenade that was lobbed by a member of the Istiklal party, which was very anti-Jewish. But according to Karkoukli, his colleague was responsible for three of the bombs.
Wow.
And that he acted under orders from an officer in Israeli intelligence named Max Binet, who was based in Tehran. In those days, the Shah's Iran had close covert relations with the state of Israel. So Max Binet is the one who provided the instructions, the information, and the TNT, the explosives, to Karkoukli, who carried out three of the bombs. Basri was caught with his assistant, and they were tortured, and they were brought to trial. They were convicted and convicted to death by hanging. But it was a proper trial with proper evidence, and the foreign press and representatives from all the embassies were invited to attend. Mm. So it wasn't a show trial. Mm. And interestingly, Basri was not accused of all the five bombs, but only the ones that he had perpetrated himself.
Yes.
So I said to Kukli, I believe you, and this fits in with all the evidence that I have, but that's not enough. I need concrete, hard evidence. Mm-hmm. And one day he produced hard evidence in the form of a one-page police report,
yes,
which gave details of the interrogation of Basri and his assistant. And the information in this page could have only come from an inside source. No one outside the police could have known it. Mm. But the problem with this page is that it was typed in Arabic on plain paper with no date, with no name, with no official letter heading, with no subject line. Mm. It was just the text reporting details of the interrogation. So this wasn't exactly a smoking gun, mm, but it was hard evidence.
Yes.
And one day I managed to make contact with an Iraqi journalist who had written a book in Arabic on the Zionist underground in Iraq and the migration of the Jews to Israel in 1950-51. Mm. This journalist, Shamil Abdul Qadir, confirmed that the page I have is from a police report, and it's a much longer police report, 258 pages, mm, which he has, but he wasn't willing to give me access. But he confirmed that all the information in the page that I have comes from the police report. Right. So I now can say with confidence that I have found incontrovertible evidence, yes, of Israeli involvement in the bombings in Baghdad that precipitated the mass exodus to Israel. My critics say to me that I exaggerate the impact of the bombs, that the real reason for the mass exodus was persecution, mm, anti-Semitism. Mm. And the Jews had started registering to leave before the bombing in the synagogue.
Yes.
And my answer to my critics is that even if I knew that the Jewish-inspired bombs did not result in one Jew leaving the country, I would still condemn this operation. Yes. I would still condemn it because Israel was created to provide a safe haven for Jews. Israel was not created in order to... it was not established in order to make Jews insecure and unsafe in the countries in which they lived. Mm. And these bombs were directed against civilians, not against the foreign army. Mm. That's why I call this cruel Zionism.
Thank you. That's really an amazing journey as a historian. Now, these false flag operations were not isolated to Iraq, but also they occurred across the Middle East. Can you please expand on or explain these attempts undertaken by Mossad undertaken by Israeli intelligence, and I suppose the ultimate aim behind them.
The most famous case of an Israeli false flag operation occurred in Cairo in 1954. This is known as the Lavon affair because Pinchas Lavon was the Minister of Defense at the time. An Israeli intelligence officer named Max Binet was in charge of the operation, and there was a cell of local Jews, Egyptian Jews, operating under his instructions. One day, a member of this cell wanted to explode, set off a bomb in a cinema in Cairo, but it went off prematurely with smoke, so he was arrested and the whole cell was rounded up, including Max Binet. And the aim of this false flag operation was to create bad blood between the Nasser regime that had just come to power after the revolution in 1952. The aim was to create bad blood between the Nasser regime and the West. And Britain still had a major military presence in the Suez Canal zone, and Britain had negotiated an agreement with the Egyptian government to vacate this base. And one major aim of the Nasser revolution was to get rid of colonial presence on their country. And the aim of the Israeli false flag operation was to say to the West, the Nasser regime cannot be trusted, and therefore they should maintain their presence, colonial presence, in Egypt. That was the aim. But the operation backfired, Max Binet is the same officer who had been responsible for the bombs in Baghdad, and he committed suicide in prison in Cairo after he had heard that the Iraqi government asked for his extradition. So there is a link between the two operations. They're separate operations, but they're both part of a pattern of false flag operations. And Pinchas Lavon, who denied the that he had given the order to activate the ring in Cairo, said in evidence to an Israeli commission of inquiry that these false flag operations, they were stupid and inhuman. And it all started in Baghdad in 1950. Now, I call this both operations cruel Zionism because they involved recruiting decent local Jews, indoctrinating them into Zionism, and getting them to act as spies against the country, but worse still, turning decent local Jews into terrorists who plant bombs in order to frighten other Jews to leave the country. To answer your question, that's why I call it cruel Zionism, because this had very serious consequences for the Jewish community in Egypt. It's not just that it backfired and it failed and it didn't achieve any of its objectives, but there was a Jewish community in Egypt, and now Egyptians started to question their loyalty to the country. They started seeing local Jews as a threat to Egypt's security, and that had very unfortunate consequences for Muslim-Jewish relations in Egypt, as it had done in Iraq before.
You are a historian of international relations, and Iraq, your mother country, is today riven by sectarian violence, maybe as a byproduct of US occupation. But across the Middle East, you're seeing a very tumultuous period of history. I suppose, could Jews have survived this post-Ottoman nationalistic Middle East? Was the writing on the wall already there for Jews in the region?
The Jews thrived under the Ottoman Empire. Mm-hmm. The Ottoman Empire, for all its faults, was a multi-ethnic, multilingual empire, which allowed a very high degree of religious and civil autonomy to all the minorities. Yeah. So it was quite a flexible framework for the region. There were open borders. You can travel from everywhere to anywhere you wanted within the empire. And each community was left in peace to run its own affairs according to its own laws and customs. Mm. So the Jews, like all the other minorities, did well under this system. Mm. And the logic of the Ottoman Empire was pluralism. Mm. And each community could maintain multiple loyalties. They could have loyalty to the Sultan, loyalty to the Ottoman Empire, but also loyalty to their own community. What happened after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire was that the colonial powers, Britain and France, built a new order which didn't suit the region. And the hallmark of the post-Ottoman order in the Middle East was lack of legitimacy. The rulers lacked legitimacy because they were handpicked by the British and the French. The political system lacked legitimacy because there was no democracy and there was no freedom. And the borders of the new states lacked legitimacy because they cut across genuine societies. They were artificial borders drawn by the colonial powers. So the hallmark of this whole order was lack of legitimacy, and it's what I call the post-Ottoman syndrome, which has resulted in never-ending strife, conflicts, bloodshed, and war that continues to this day. Today we see the consequence of that order in Gaza. Mm-hmm. Could the Jews have survived and after the end of the Ottoman Empire in the Arab world? I don't know the answer to that. Mm-hmm. I think the answer is yes. But everything changed because the logic of the new system, the logic of the new order was nationalism. And you could only have one identification to your nation. And nationalism is a very divisive and destructive force. It's not a positive force.
Yes.
Patriotism is different. Patriotism is one of one's love of one's country. Mm. For nationalism, you need an enemy. And as Marilyn Monroe wrote in her scrapbook, nationalism stops us thinking. And this is my gloss on what she said. Nationalism stops us relating to one another as human beings. And that is what happened. And in Palestine, you couldn't have dual loyalty, multiple loyalties. You're either an Arab or a Jew. And Britain and the conflict started there. The Arab-Israeli conflict was made in Britain.
So let's talk about the current crisis. And there is a a perception that there is a racial dimension to the conflict. Many Palestinians are looked down as being inferior, and their lives are seen to be of less meaning to wider Israeli society. Is it fair to call the Israeli state project a racial enterprise? And you know, is that a historically acceptable label to give to Zionism?
I'll begin by saying that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is not about religion and not about race. Essentially, it's a clash between two national movements,
right?
Palestinian nationalism and Zionism. There are two peoples and one land. That's what the conflict is essentially about. But then there are other layers to this conflict, and religion became an increasingly important factor in what was had been a secular conflict. On both sides, religion became a more important factor, and the combination of religion and politics is a very explosive mixture. And Hamas is the Islamic resistance movement. So Islam is central to this movement. It's not peripheral. And Israel, at the same time, has become more and more of a Jewish state, and I would say a Jewish supremacist state. And religion has become a more important factor in shaping Israeli policy towards the Palestinians. And indeed towards the Palestinian citizens of the State of Israel. I'll answer your question. Israel is a racist state.
Really?
And the evidence for that is the July 2018 Jewish Nation State Law, which says that the Jewish people have a unique right to self-determination within the State of Israel. For unique, read exclusive. And it means that the nearly 2 million Palestinian citizens of the State of Israel, about a fifth of the population, they have no national rights. So this law creates two classes of citizens, Jews who are superior and Palestinians, citizens of the State of Israel, who are inferior and don't enjoy the same rights. Israel, because of this law, Israel may be said to be the only officially racist state, the only officially racist state member of the United Nations. Right. There are many other racist countries, but they don't officially say that they are racist. But this is not everything. Israel continued to move in the direction of racism, of overt racism. Look at the present government, which is headed by Benjamin Netanyahu. This government, its policy guidelines, every government which has to be approved by the Knesset has to present its program, the policy guidelines. And the policy guidelines of the present Netanyahu government say that the Jewish people have an exclusive right to self-determination in the whole land of Israel. So now it says not unique, but exclusive. And it says that the Jewish people have an exclusive right to self-determination, not just within the State of Israel, but within the whole land of Israel, yeah. which includes the West Bank. Mm. So the short answer to your question is yes, Israel is a racist project.
Can I ask you about Palestine or Palestinians as a group of people? There are many Israelis who argue that Palestinians as an entity are a mythical people. I mean, how rooted were the Palestinians to what we call Palestine in 1948?
The Arabs had lived in Palestine for centuries.
Yes.
Until the beginning of Jewish immigration to Palestine. And the turning point was the Balfour Declaration of 1917, which promised British support for a Jewish national home in Palestine. And this was a classical colonial document. Mm. In 1917, the Jews were 10% of the population.
Yeah.
The Arabs were 90%. The Jews owned 2% of the land. Mm. And yet Britain chose to allocate national rights to the Jewish minority and to deny it to the Arab majority.
Right.
And
hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
It was this British commitment and support for the Zionist movement that enabled the Zionist movement to embark on the systematic takeover of Palestine, a process that continues to this day with the expansion of Jewish settlements on the West Bank. Mm. So there was an Arab community, well-established, well-rooted Arab community in Palestine going back centuries before the rise of Zionism and the State of Israel.
Yeah.
One argument about Palestinian nationalism is that it's not genuine nationalism. Mm. It only developed in response to the Zionist project in Palestine.
Yeah.
But there is nothing unusual about it. Most nationalisms are not positive movements. Yeah. They arise in opposition to something else.
Yes.
So the Palestinian nationalism is nothing unusual, and it really took off the ground in the aftermath of the First World War, but it's still a very genuine national movement, and the PLO used to represent that national movement.
Yeah.
And Hamas today is the main representative of Palestinian nationalism and resistance to the occupation.
So you've raised there the Balfour Declaration. This was a letter written by Arthur Balfour, the foreign secretary in the then coalition government in the United Kingdom. Why did Britain give such an open promise for a Jewish homeland. What was their ultimate motivation behind that?
I believe that the Balfour Declaration was based on a misperception.
Right.
On a mistake. And the driving force behind the Balfour Declaration was not Foreign Secretary Arthur Balfour, but Prime Minister David Lloyd George. Mm. David Lloyd George believed that the Jews were a uniquely influential people, that they had covert power, that they made the wheels of history turn. And by issuing this declaration, Britain would gain a strategic partner in the war against Germany. This view in itself was anti-Semitic, that the Jews enjoyed covert financial power around the world, that the Jews were so influential. But it was an exaggeration. But the truth of the matter was that the Jews were a minority in Britain and everywhere, and the Zionists were a tiny minority within the Jewish community in Britain.
Yeah.
And it's really important to understand that the mainstream Jewish community in Britain was opposed to Zionism. Mm. There was only one Jewish member of Lloyd George's government, and that was Sir Edwin Montagu, the Secretary of State for India. And on the 23rd of August 1917, 3 months before the Balfour Declaration was issued, Montagu submitted a memorandum, 4-page memorandum, to the British cabinet under the heading the anti-Semitism of the present government.
Wow.
And this is the first and major Jewish statement against Zionism.
Yeah.
And Montagu began by saying, Judaism is a religion. It's not a nation. There are Jews who live all around the world. They speak different languages. They have different cultures.
Yeah.
And therefore, it doesn't make sense to have a Jewish state in Palestine. Moreover, if there is a Jewish state in Palestine, it would undermine the struggle for equal rights for Jews in this country and in Europe and everywhere else.
Yeah.
Because if there is a Jewish state in Palestine, anyone who didn't like Jews will say to the Jews, if you don't like it here, why don't you go to your own country? Mm. So this is a very important and little-known document, which shows that the Jewish community as a whole, the mainstream, did not support the Zionist project. And the Balfour Declaration, when viewed not from the Zionist side, but when viewed from the point of view of British interest, was a colossal strategic blunder.
Really?
Because it alienated the Arabs, it alienated the Muslim world, and if Britain had wanted a strategic ally, then it should have been the Arabs, who were already its ally during the First World War. But Britain was very cynical, and in the course of fighting the First World War, Britain made 3 incompatible promises. In 1915, it promised Hussein the Sharif of Mecca In return for mounting an Arab revolt against the Ottoman Empire, they promised him an independent Arab kingdom under his rule at the end of the war. The following year, in 1916, Britain signed a secret treaty with France, the Sykes-Picot Agreement, in which the colonial powers divided the Middle East into zones of influence between themselves.
Yeah.
So this clearly contradicted the promise of an independent Arab kingdom. But they couldn't agree on Palestine, so Palestine was not in either sphere of influence. It was to have a separate international administration.
Yeah.
But worse was to come. In 1917, Britain issued the Balfour Declaration, pledging its support for the Zionist cause. Now, the difference, and Britain completely let down Hussein the Sharif of Mecca and reneged on its promise of an independent Arab kingdom.
Mm.
But there is a difference between the Sykes-Picot Agreement and the Balfour Declaration. Mm. The Sykes-Picot Agreement was never implemented. Lloyd George reneged on it. But the Balfour Declaration was implemented. And in 1922, it was Britain which wrote which incorporated the Balfour Declaration into the League of Nations mandate in Palestine. Mm. So what had been a vague British promise to the Zionists became an international instrument, and Britain had as the mandatory power to help the emergence of a national home for the Jews in Palestine. The Sykes-Picot Agreement and the Balfour Declaration are the guiding themes, the central themes of Arab nationalists to this day. They are still relevant at the symbolic level. The Sykes-Picot Agreement was a symbol of colonial indifference to Arab rights and Arab aspirations. It was a symbol of the colonial powers carving up the territory for their own selfish ends. And the Balfour Declaration represents, is a symbol of the European colonial powers introducing a foreign body, a Jewish state, into the midst of the Middle East. And Arabs to this day believe that this was deliberate, to create a Jewish state in the middle, in the heartland of the Arab world, in order to divide and weaken the Arabs, and in order to defeat Arab nationalism. I'd like to make one other point,
please,
if I may.
Yes.
The League of Nations mandate for Palestine was unique. There were four mandates.
Yeah.
The League of Nations gave France the mandate for Syria and the mandate for Lebanon.
Mm.
And it gave Britain two mandates, the mandate for Iraq and the mandate for Palestine.
Right.
All the other, the three mandates, Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq, called on the mandatory power to prepare the country for independence, for self-rule, and when the country was ready, to hand over power to the locals. Mm-hmm. The Palestine mandate was different because the Balfour Declaration was incorporated into the mandate. Britain was now obliged to turn Palestine into a national home for the Jewish people. not to prepare the locals for self-government, but to prepare Palestine to be taken over by Jews from all over the world, and especially from Europe. In this sense, the Palestine Mandate was unique, and that encapsulates the deep, deep injustice, the fundamental injustice that the British Mandate involved towards the local population.
So can I ask you about David Lloyd George? He was the Prime Minister at the time, and he's known to be an ardent Christian Zionist. How much did his religious views impact his attitude, I suppose, towards Arabs and ultimately towards the Balfour Declaration and the creation of a Jewish state?
David Lloyd George had biblical education, which he used to invoke in relation to foreign policy. He knew all the biblical names for present-day Palestine. And he said that he was influenced by his sympathy for the Jewish people to issue the Balfour Declaration. But I completely dismiss this as irrelevant.
Yeah.
David Lloyd George was a radical at home, but he was an old-fashioned British imperialist abroad and a land grabber. And all his decisions relating to the Balfour Declaration were cynical imperial calculations. Yeah. But he was wrong about the influence of the Jews. And Britain was saddled with this commitment to a Jewish national home, which really hobbled Britain in the interwar period and soured its relations with the Arabs. So it's not just David Lloyd George.
Yeah.
There is a view that biblical romanticism was the driving force behind the Balfour Declaration. And it may have existed in British society in general, but it wasn't a serious motive for the British policymakers.
Right.
And therefore, I completely reject the notion, which is still persistent to this day in some quarters, I completely reject the notion that the Balfour Declaration was a noble Christian project to enable an ancient people to rebuild its national home on its ancestral homeland.
And can I ask, I mean, your wife is the great-granddaughter of David Lloyd George. What's her views on the Balfour Declaration, but also on Palestine today?
My wife is a great-granddaughter of David Lloyd George, and she's very proud of him and of his radical agenda and his radical achievement in home affairs. But she's extremely embarrassed by the Balfour Declaration.
Really?
And she is a pro-Palestinian activist. She's very active in promoting the Palestinian cause.
Yeah.
But when she goes to the West Bank and she meets with Palestinians, she's very acutely embarrassed by her ancestry. So her attitude towards Lloyd George is ambivalent. Mm-hmm. Admiration for his radicalism on the one hand, and deep disappointment and anger for the support that he gave to Zionism and for the Balfour Declaration in particular.
Thank you. Can I ask you about the Nakba in 1948? Now, Israel presents a narrative that it was largely done through mass migration for immigration and voluntary dispersal of the Palestinians. What's the truth behind that episode?
There is the master Zionist narrative, which says that in 1947, the UN voted for the partition of Palestine.
Mm.
into two states, one Arab, one Jewish. The Arabs rejected partition and went to war to frustrate partition. And they were defeated in that war. And in the course of the war, the Palestinians left Palestine. They left on orders from above, and in the expectation of a triumphal return. So Israel is not responsible for the Palestinian refugee problem. Three quarters of a million Palestinians became refugees, not a small number, more than half the population. And I'm a new historian, so-called new historian. The three original new historians are Benny Morris, Ilan Pape, and myself. And in 1988, the three of us published books on what happened in 1948. Ilan Pape's book challenges the Zionist claim that towards the end of the mandate, Britain's aim was to frustrate the birth of a Jewish state, that Britain armed and incited its Arab allies to invade Palestine upon end of the mandate and frustrate the birth of a Jewish state. Ilan Pape shows that Britain's real aim was to frustrate the birth of a Palestinian state. So there is a case against Britain at the end of the mandate, but not that it tried to prevent the birth of a Jewish state, but that it succeeded in preventing the birth, aborting the birth of a Palestinian state. Benny Morris wrote The Birth of the Palestinian Refugee Problem, 1947 and 1949. This book is based on meticulous research in the Israeli archives. And the conclusion is that there are many reasons for the Palestinian exodus, but the main reason was Jewish, economic, political, military, and psychological pressure. In other words, the refugee problem had many causes, but the main cause was Israeli actions. And there are many, many examples there expulsion of Palestinians. It wasn't voluntary. So the Zionist narrative is that the Palestinians left, and Benny Morris shows that they didn't leave of their own accord, that they were pushed out. I would actually use the phrase ethnic cleansing. There was no Zionist master plan for the expulsion of the Palestinians, but there was a very definite aim of getting rid of as many Palestinians as possible. And if you look at the outcome, regardless of the intentions, the outcome is that three quarters of a million Palestinians became refugees, and the name Palestine was wiped off the map. The term ethnic cleansing didn't exist then, but I think it applies. And I agree with Ilan Pape, who wrote another book, which is called The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. That is the Nakba. My own book was called Collusion Across the Jordan. King Abdullah, the Zionist Movement, and the Partition of Palestine. And in this book, I advance a main thesis, which is that by 1947, King Abdullah of Jordan and the Jewish Agency reached a tacit agreement to divide Palestine not into an Arab state and a Jewish state, but to divide Palestine between themselves at the expense of the Palestinians.
Wow.
And this was indeed the outcome of the 1948 war. King Abdullah's army invaded Palestine, captured the West Bank, the heartland of what was to be the Palestinian state, and later incorporated into it into his kingdom. And Israel extended its borders beyond those granted by the UN cartographers. The losers were the Palestinians, and they were left out in the cold. So my book upturns the whole historiography of the Arab-Israeli conflict in the first half of the 20th century. The conventional narrative is that it was a straightforward, bipolar conflict between Jews on the one hand and all the Arab world on the other hand.
Yeah.
Whereas I argue that below the surface, the real lineup was between Hashemite rulers of Jordan and Zionists on the one hand against the Palestinians and Arab nationalists on the other hand. So this is, in a nutshell, the new history. My colleagues and I, between us, launch a frontal attack on all the myths that have come to surround the birth of Israel and the first Arab-Israeli war.
Can we discuss the current slaughter, I suppose we can call it that, of Gazans? It's now been 3 months, and it's clear to you and I that there is a form of ethnic cleansing taking place, similar to that of the Nakba in 1948. I want to ask you a question about history and historians. I mean, are you confident that in the future, historians will look back and see these events in the same way you and I see them? I suppose I'm asking the question, is all history essentially a politicized version of history?
No. There is a difference between good history and bad history.
Right.
And bad history is a history with a political axe to grind, where the agenda dominates the research and the writing.
Yeah.
And good history is more detached, more objective history. But you're right in saying that the historian doesn't operate in a vacuum.
That's true.
The historian is a member of his society.
Yeah.
The historian addresses the questions that are current at the time of writing. Mm. And I have no way of knowing how future historians would look back on what's happening in Gaza today.
Yeah.
But I am confident, on the basis of what I know, that what is unfolding in front of our eyes today is ethnic cleansing, the ethnic cleansing of Gaza. And I would go further and say we're also seeing the beginning of what might be called genocide. Genocide is much more extreme than ethnic cleansing.
Yeah.
For the ethnic cleansing, we have all the evidence that Israel has ordered the Palestinians to move from north to the south of the Strip. There are 2.3 million residents in Gaza. Mm. 1.9 million have already been displaced, sometimes a second time. And some of the Palestinians who have obeyed Israeli orders are then bombed by Israeli airstrikes. Mm. The forcible movement, the forcible coercion of civilians to move from their homes is a war crime.
Yeah.
So Israel is committing war crimes already by the orders, by the displacement of the Palestinians within the Gaza Strip. But Israeli ambition doesn't end there.
Yeah.
The Israeli ambition is to get rid of as many of the Palestinians in Gaza as possible. Benjamin Netanyahu, in an address to the nation, said, "We are fighting our second war of independence." This is complete nonsense. It's preposterous. No one is threatening Israel's independence. That's not the issue. And behind his words, I see a veiled threat that the first war of independence was accompanied by the Nakba, and this war of independence, as he sees it, will be accompanied by another Nakba. And some Israeli leaders are actually talking about a second Nakba, and some of them are saying the scale of the second Nakba is going to be bigger. And this is not just speculation on my part. A document of the Israeli Ministry of Intelligence dated 13 October came to light, and it has a plan for the depopulation of Gaza, for pushing a large number of the Palestinians from Gaza into northern Sinai, into Egyptian territory. Obviously, Egypt is strongly opposed to any such move, but that is an Israeli ambition. And what we are noticing now is very disturbing, genocidal rhetoric. I think there is no precedent for this kind of open genocidal rhetoric that we are seeing today. People don't usually advertise the intention to carry out genocide. They try to hide it. Whereas Israeli leaders, from top to bottom, are issuing extraordinary statements, like President Herzog says there are no innocent people in Gaza. Well, I beg to differ. Israel has killed 22,000 people, nearly 10,000 children. Two-thirds of the death toll are women and children. They are innocent. And yet, more and more Israeli leaders are demonizing the Palestinians, calling for their expulsion, calling openly for ethnic cleansing. One rabbi said that Israel should drop a bomb, an atomic bomb, on Gaza. And this worries me a great deal, the genocidal rhetoric, because usually demonizing the enemy leads or justifies extermination and genocide. So this is not just loose talk. It's very serious dehumanizing, not just of Hamas, but of the entire Palestinian people.
In recent weeks and months, there's been a ferocious debate here in the West about context. I suppose it's what you call good history. Now, the 7th of October is a hotly debated topic. And of course, much of what Israel has done has been justified by the 7th of October. The detractors, those who argue against Israel's case, would suggest that there is a context to the violence of the 7th of October. How important is it for us to explore that context? And what is the context behind what happened on the 7th of October?
The 7th of October Hamas attack on Israel was vicious, was traumatic, and it involved the killing of 1,200 Israelis, mostly civilians, and taking as hostages 240 others. And it was an attack on Israel, not through firing rockets on Israeli territory, but for the first time, it was a ground attack. On the settlements, on kibbutz around Gaza, and on a music festival in which about 250 participants in the festival were killed. Yeah. So it was a horrific, horrific attack on Israel,
yeah.
And I denounce it. But it didn't happen in a vacuum. There was a history behind it, and we won't understand why it happened unless we understand the context.
Yeah.
And the context is one of 56 years of Israeli occupation. And this is the most prolonged and brutal occupation, military occupation, of modern times.
Yeah.
Israelis were utterly shocked and horrified by the Hamas attack, and Israeli society became unhinged by the scale and ferocity of this attack.
Yeah.
But Palestinians have, on the West Bank and Gaza, have been living under Israeli occupation for 56 years. They've been subjected to horrific conditions, to daily violations of the basic human rights and oppression. And even after Israel withdrew unilaterally from Gaza in 2005, it didn't give the Gazans freedom, as it claims. It put them in an open-air prison and imposed a blockade on Gaza long before this conflict in Gaza, long before the outbreak of the current round of fighting in Gaza. So Israel is an oppressive colonial power, and there is Palestinian resistance, naturally.
Yeah.
The Palestinian Authority in Ramallah doesn't represent any resistance. It has become the subcontractor for Israeli security. That is why it lacks legitimacy. Whereas Hamas is the only body which represents real resistance, national resistance to the Israeli occupation. And another element in the context was Netanyahu saying to the Israeli people, the Palestinians are finished. The Palestinians are defeated. We can do whatever we like on the West Bank, whatever we like, and we can continue to expand settlements and put people in prison without charge. As for Gaza, it's contained within the prison. And on the 7th of October, the prison inmates broke out of the prison. So that's the context.
Yeah.
There is one other reason for the Hamas attack on the 7th of October, and that is that some Arab countries have betrayed the Palestinians. In March 2002, there was an Arab League summit meeting in Beirut, and it adopted what became known as the Arab Peace Initiative. And the Arab Peace Initiative offers Israel full peace and normalization with all 22 members of the Arab League, in return for an end of occupation and a Palestinian state on the West Bank in Gaza, with the capital city in East Jerusalem. This is the deal of the century. This is what Israel had always been asking for before 1967, and yet Israel ignored the Arab Peace Initiative and continues to ignore it and to reject it to this day. In 2020, four Arab countries signed the so-called Abraham Accords with Israel. They're the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan. They completely abandoned the Arab Peace Initiative. they made peace with Israel on Netanyahu's terms, which is peace for peace rather than land for peace. So Israel didn't have to pay any price in terms of concessions to the Palestinians or Palestinian independence to get these four agreements.
Yes.
And there was strong American pressure on Saudi Arabia to join the circle of the Abraham Accords.
Yeah.
And negotiations were far advanced, and it was a matter of weeks before Saudi Arabia was going to sign an agreement with Israel. And that would have been a stab in the back to the Palestinians, and that would have been the end of any Arab support for Palestinian independence. And by launching this attack, Hamas forced Saudi Arabia to think again of whether they will really want to go down this route. So the Hamas attack, for all its terrorist and brutal aspects, is still an assertion of Palestinian agency. The message was, we are still here, and Palestinian resistance under the leadership of Hamas is going to continue.
Can I ask you about internal Israeli dynamics? Now, there is a perception that a lot of what is happening in Gaza, the sheer violence, the settler activity in the West Bank, is really down to the religious right and the coalition that has been mustered together by the Likud party, by Netanyahu. People like Smotrich and others are really inflaming the Palestinian territories for their own benefit. We did see last year, before this crisis, we did see mass demonstrations on the streets of Tel Aviv and elsewhere, suggesting that Israeli society is divided. How believable do you think the belief is, or the perception is, that if Netanyahu went, the attitude towards the Palestinians would be moderated?
There is the view that I don't share, that Netanyahu is a moderating force within his coalition, that there is the extreme, very extreme wing of the coalition, which consists of Jewish power led by Itamar Ben-Gvir,
yes,
and religious Zionism led by Bezalel Smotrich. There are outright racists and Jewish supremacists. They don't try to conceal it. And they call openly for the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, not just of Gaza, but of the West Bank as well. And their aim, declared aim, is ethnic cleansing and the formal annexation of the West Bank. And Netanyahu is no moderate. Netanyahu is an extreme Jewish nationalist who hates Arabs and would like to get rid of the Arabs. His life mission is to defeat Arab to defeat Palestinian nationalism. And he has declared repeatedly that there would be no Palestinian state on his watch. And now that the war in Gaza has been going on for 3 months, the Americans are beginning to put pressure on him to agree to the day after, a political plan for the day after. And the Americans would like to bring the Palestinian Authority back into Gaza, to rule Gaza. And this is, of course, not acceptable to the people in Gaza.
Yeah.
To impose on them the Palestinian Authority on the back of Israeli tanks. That's a complete non-starter. So Netanyahu doesn't have any political plan for the day after. His war aim is to destroy Hamas, which is impossible to achieve.
Yeah.
And indefinite Israeli security control of Gaza. But that leaves open the question of who will govern Gaza. The present government, Netanyahu included, make for what is the most ultra-right, the most nationalistic, the most openly racist, and openly homophobic government in Israel's history. And also, this government is dominated by the settlers' lobby, to a greater extent than any previous Israeli government.
Yeah.
So one problem is the Israeli occupation of the West Bank, mm-hmm. and another problem is that the settlers now occupy the Israeli government. Mm-hmm. They are the government, and they make policy.
Yeah.
And it's a terrifying prospect.
How about the liberals and the left in Israel? Would we find a kinder policy towards the Palestinians if they were offered power?
There was a mass protest against Netanyahu and his judicial reform program.
Yeah.
The aim of that program was to reduce the powers of the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And the driving force behind the judicial reform are the extreme parties that I've just mentioned.
Yes.
Because they know that the Supreme Court would rule as illegal some of the measures that they want to implement, like the annexation of the West Bank.
Yeah.
But this is also an attack, the reform is also an attack on Israeli democracy, because it reduces the rights of Israeli citizens and freedom of speech. Mm. So there was huge protest against Netanyahu and the judicial reform. But once the attack of Hamas happened on the 7th of October, all the focus was changed to Gaza and to the hostages. And now Netanyahu has alienated most Israelis. And the protest is against him personally.
Yes.
Because he's held responsible for the collapse of security on the 7th of October. And it wasn't just one attack, but his whole policy built around the notion that the Palestinians have been defeated. Mm. His whole policy has collapsed. And he's held responsible. And that protest against him. And he knows that once the fighting stops, the countdown to the end of his premiership will begin. Mm. So he's now fighting for political survival, because as long as he is prime minister, he cannot be tried. Mm. And he has pending three serious files of corruption against him, and he knows that when he stops being prime minister, he will stand trial, and most probably he'll be convicted and he'll end up in prison. Mm. And the tragedy for Israel as a whole is that this uniquely selfish and terrible man is now prolonging the war and the carnage and the destruction in Gaza for his own selfish ends.
Can I ask you one final question? And it's really about the UK political scene. You're a Labour Party member, and it seems to me that the leader of the opposition, Keir Starmer, has probably gone even further than the Conservatives in defending Israel's right to defend itself and to enact revenge upon the Gazans. How do you reflect on the current Labour Party position?
Sir Keir Starmer is one example of a wider phenomenon, which is Western hypocrisy on Israel-Palestine. And you see that hypocrisy in the American administration during this conflict in Gaza. It's America which has stopped a ceasefire from taking place, and America is supplying Israel with war material. So America is not just complicit in Israeli war crimes. America is an active belligerent alongside Israel against the Palestinian people. Most European countries are the same. The British government has always been one-sidedly pro-Israeli and totally indifferent to Palestinian rights. But Keir Starmer is an interesting example because he has declared himself to be an unconditional Zionist. That's an odd position for a politician to take. Surely, and he's a lawyer, he's a human rights lawyer, surely he should make his support for Israel conditional on Israel abiding by international law and Israel respecting human rights. But no, he gives Israel a free pass to do its worst.
Yeah.
And he was interviewed during this current crisis, and he defended Israel, and he said that Israel has the right to defend itself. And the interviewer asked him, does Israel have the right to stop water and food and fuel and medical supplies to the civilian population of Gaza? And his reply was, Israel has the right to defend itself. He later tried to backtrack from that, but that's his basic position. Israel, right or wrong, regardless of international law, regardless of the abuses, regardless of the war crimes, he is still an unconditional supporter of Israel. And one other thing about Sir Keir Starmer, he was asked, is Israel, do you think Israel is an apartheid state? And he said no, he doesn't think so. But four major human rights organizations in the last 3 years have issued reports, detailed reports, all of which conclude that Israel is guilty of the international crime of apartheid. So it's completely preposterous for a British politician and a human rights advocate to be denying that Israel is an apartheid state.
Thank you very much. I mean, I'm struck by how razor sharp your memory is, Professor Abushalem. How do you keep your memory so sharp?
Well, I'm a historian, and you can't be a historian unless you have a good memory.
Yes.
But also, I'm old. I'm 78 years old.
Wow.
I've been a university teacher for 53 years.
Yeah.
And knowledge is cumulative. So for the last 40 years or so, my main research interest has been the Arab-Israeli conflict. But I'm not an ivory tower historian.
No.
I'm interested in what's going on around me. And there is so much misinformation. And in the media today, so much misinformation about Hamas, about the Palestinians, about Israel.
Yeah.
And I regard it as my duty to share my knowledge with the wider public, not just to write scholarly work for other scholars, but to try and reach a wider public to educate them about the reality of this tragic conflict between Israelis and Palestinians. And I'm grateful to you for giving me this opportunity to speak to your audience.
Thank you very much. I'm really grateful for your time today. Thank you, Professor Abushalem.
Thank you.
Please remember to subscribe to our social media and YouTube channels and head over to our website thinkingmuslim.com to sign up to my weekly newsletter. Jazakallah khair.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.